Our scripture reading this morning, Matthew 25, verses 31 through 46. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at his left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, "Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me." Then he will say to those at his left hand, "You that are accursed, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to eat or drink. I was a stranger, you did not welcome me, naked, and you did not clothe me, sick and in prison, and you did not visit me." Then they will also answer, "Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you?" Then he will again answer them, "Truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life.
Did you know that 783 million people don't have access to clean water? 37% of those people live in sub-Saharan Africa. Like us, those 783 million people don't have a faucet that they can turn on whenever they want. They have to walk several miles, which takes hours on end, just so they can fill up a jerry can with water. The jerry can, when full, weighs about 40 pounds. Girls under the age of 15 are twice as likely as boys to be the family member responsible for fetching water. Even if there is a source of water nearby, the water is often contaminated with bacteria. Nearly one out of every five deaths under the age of five is caused by water-related diseases. Not only does water-related diseases make people sick, it also diminishes kids' chances at getting a solid education. Approximately 443 million school days are lost each year due to water-related diseases. Without a water source near a school, there is more than likely going to be no sanitation facilities. As a result, many girls often drop out of school at puberty. By investing in clean water alone, young children around the world can gain more than 413 million days of health. We visited a city in Uganda called Rakai. It's in the middle of nowhere up in the hills. They had zero wells near them, and we were actually leaving to go back to our hotel one night, and we saw, I think it was 3 or 4 little kids carrying big jerry cans, and they were filling up them in a little marsh on the side of the road filled with algae, on like a layer of algae on top of the water, and it was just disgusting. And it's the bottom picture right there on the bottom right. That's the kids that we saw filling up their cans. That was definitely like a low point in the trip because everyone knew that the medicine we were giving them wouldn't do anything. But when we came back, my mom actually talked to one of her friends, and he actually decided to pay for a well. But sadly, it turned out that he wouldn't be able to buy a well because there wasn't running water there, so we wouldn't be able to make a new well. But luckily, we did find out that there were 5 wells in the area that needed to be fixed. So he ended up fixing 4 out of the 5 wells. And then a couple weeks ago, we actually received an email from Reverend Davis Mutovu, who's actually coming here in a couple weeks. And he said, "Doc, I just got back from the Rakai wells since Monday. This has been the busiest week of my year. I am very excited that I have 4 wells redone and thousands of people provided with clean water. The most exciting thing today was witnessing a youth of 25 years gasp with unbelief at watching a well he had all his life called the dummy bring forth water. The whole sub-county is buzzing with news that the Christians have done. Wait for my report, and I have discovered 7 more wells. Blessings from Davis." We take running water for granted so often and never realize how the other half of the world lives. It's pretty good. Makama Yeba Zibwe, which means praise the Lord.
This morning, playing the role of Brandon Miller, will be me, which is actually a good thing on many levels, not in that way, because Brandon probably wouldn't tell this story. He's not one to boast about things that he's passionate about, and what I'm going to talk about today is, I kind of framed as saying it, about little things having big impacts, and this is kind of multi-leveled. When we were in Rakai, we had after 2 car tire blowouts and sitting on the side of the road being giggled at by the locals as the Mzungus were waiting for their van to be fixed. When we finally got to Rakai, we were behind schedule. Everything was kind of all botched up, but we were able to meet with the folks. We had taken some medicine, some deworming medicines, as Hannah said. We were there because of the water illness, the illnesses caused by the water. So we brought some deworming medicines to give to the kids. So Kathy and I and Vicky and Hannah, and actually everybody, were involved in this. We were giving them medications. We were marking them because if you give them a double dose, it's not a good thing. So we made sure that we had a system in place to make sure that the kids were taken care of and that they didn't come back through because, as I said in the children's moments, for medications, everybody wanted it. Everybody wanted it because they never had it. So if one is good, 2 must be better. So we tried to make sure that that didn't happen, and we were pretty certain that it didn't. But of course, once word gets out that you have a nurse, Mrs. Weaver, she becomes like a rock star, and everybody wants to show you something or tell you something or ask you something about something that's wrong with them or some malady that they have going on. So as we're there, a couple people came up, and Kathy very graciously looked at them and took care of them the way she could. But we had one situation that really impacted Brandon and myself, and I think almost everybody on the team. We were, a mother came up and through an interpreter told us that her son had recently been circumcised. So we bring the boy over, who happens to be about 10 years old and about this tall. So Kathy and I kind of discreetly took him off to the side, and we were inspecting the circumcision, which was horrific. At least in our opinion, it was horrific. It had scarred, it had scabbed over pretty severely, which was then causing him to have some urinary tract issues. And we didn't know the extent of it. Obviously, we didn't bring any sort of equipment to do anything about this. So we're kind of like, what do we do? So Kathy very quickly thought, well, we'll at least give him some bacitracin to hopefully kind of deal with the you know, currently pressing issue. We covered it and said, well, we'll see what we can do. And we instructed the mother that she needs to get him to a doctor to get this looked at and get it treated. And we could just see by the look in her eye that we had just given her not a death sentence, but a bad prognosis for her son. She was hoping that we'd be able to cure him. So we went about our business, and we left. And it really impacted Brandon. We're sitting there on the bus ride, and even before the bus ride, we're sitting there, and he pulled me aside and said, Dad, we got to do something about this. I'm like, okay, buddy, what do you want to do? He's like, we got to get him treated. We got to do something for him. So, of course, in my head, I'm going through, oh, geez, we got to take this kid in the Kampala. He's going to be in a hospital. He's going to be there for a couple days. We got to figure out how we're going to pay for this. What are we going to do? But he was steadfast. He's like, we got to do something, Dad. And I said, well, let's bring it to the group and see what they say. So that night, we get back real late. We get back to where we were staying. And when we say hotel, it wasn't bad. Yes, we've been in worse. This is not the Howard Johnsons. So we get back to the hotel. We actually, a nightly ritual that we do every night is we actually get together and we actually have coffee and we talk about what went wrong, where we saw God that day. And we're sitting there. And Brandon was very sheepish at first because he didn't want to, like, you know, interject. So, of course, me being dad and doing what I do, I pretty much said, Brandon, what's the problem? What do we got going on? So Brandon then spoke up and said, we really need to treat this kid. And we went around the group, and everybody agreed that this is something that we should do. So we then decided the next morning that we were going to find this kid and hopefully find out that, A, he went to a doctor and got treated. We figured that was about a zero chance of that happening. Then our next choice was to somehow get him to a doctor. So we were asking people at the hotel, well, where's the nearest doctor that has some medical credentials that could treat this kid? And we found out there was a town nearby that we could actually take him to get treated. So we get there that morning. Brandon's like makes a beeline looking through the crowd, finds a kid, brings him out. We talked to him, translated for the mother, and said, you know, we're going to take him and you. We're going to go to the doctor and get this thing treated. So we get to the doctor. Kathy and I go with the doctors with John, our driver, and the mom. And I can tell you, this was funny. This poor young man who's probably never seen a doctor in his life except to get the circumcision, who's probably deathly afraid of it because of what's happened, is sitting next to me, and I was wearing my Winnie the Pooh tie. So I'm looking at this poor boy, and he's just staring at my tie. He's, like, pointing at it, and I'm like, okay. So here's this poor boy who's enthralled with this ridiculously dressed Mzungu, bouncing down the road to go to a doctor. But very fortunately, Kathy and I get to the doctor, and the doctor inspects and says, wow, what happened during the night is the bacitracin actually loosened up the scar tissue and the scab, and it had come off, and it looked, in the doctor's opinion, you know, it looked great. So all we ended up having to get him was some medication, get him some antibiotics to treat his urinary tract infection that he had. But the reason I say it, and when I talk about little things having big impacts throughout life, is that little event has helped to solidify for Brandon what he wants to do with the rest of his life, at least at this point. You know, as much as a 17-year-old can know what he wants to do for the rest of his life, he had pretty much decided that he wants to go to college to be a physician assistant and to do this sort of thing with pediatrics. So, you know, there's a way that God was moving in him and through him to do something with his life. So hopefully that through that he can then have a bigger impact throughout the course of his life. And it impacted me because, you know, I couldn't be prouder of my son to watch him have this experience and to actually stand up for something that he thought was right and something that he thought needed to be done. So like I said, it just makes me a proud dad to witness something like that.
Really? I have to follow that? Good morning, everyone. As I was preparing to speak with you all today and thinking about the idea of this being Children's Sabbath, I was trying to wrap my head around the idea of step into my shoes, which is the theme that we've been talking about with the children for the last month.
What is it really like to experience hunger and thirst and a lack of resources? How can I make a difference in the lives of children around the world? What can I do as just one person? I know you're probably all expecting me to talk about Uganda this morning, but I'm gonna throw you a little curveball and talk about something that God has really laid on my heart in a way that I was able to step into another's shoes a couple years ago. In May of 2012, there was a group of 11 people from my home church in Akron that went to Haiti for a week, and my dad and I were part of that team. And we have a partnership at our church with this organization called Restore Haiti. And their mission is to, I stole this off their website, to empower communities to rise from a culture of desperation to one of restored hope and self-sustainability. As I'm sure you're all aware, Haiti is a nation that is still recovering from the devastating earthquake in 2010. And when we arrived in the capital of Port-au-Prince, we took a long, bumpy, 3-hour ride through the mountains, and we actually saw the place where the earthquake had its epicenter. And we saw this mountain that had just shaved off. And there's still people living in tents. There's devastation everywhere. And it was just overwhelming for us. So we went with Restore Haiti, and they work in a small village off the coast near a town called Jacmel. And their primary purpose is to work through child sponsorships. And through the sponsorships, they provide hot meals and education and also medical care for the children of the community there. So every single day, our main purpose was working with the feeding program that they have. And we came alongside the local leaders. And so we helped after school. They feed over 450 children every single day. And so they get a hot meal and a Flintstones vitamin, sometimes two if they sneak back around and come for another one. And so for many kids, this is the only meal that they get a day. And so it was such a privilege for us to be able to share with them, to help prepare the meal, to serve it assembly line style, to feed those 450 plus children every single day, watching them scrape their bowls clean and just leave with a smile and a full belly, knowing that we provided something for them that day. So Pastor LaFleur, who is one of the founding members of Restore Haiti, he actually grew up in that community where the feeding program is. And his vision is to transform the lives of the people in that community. And he believes that in order to transform a community, you start with the children. And so when the children receive that education, they receive that hot meal every day, when they get the medical attention and they hear about the love that Jesus has for them, they're satisfying more than just their physical needs. They're getting their emotional and their spiritual needs met. And when that happens, they take it back to their families, to their parents, and they infuse hope into their family, into their communities. So one evening during the trip, about halfway through our time in Haiti, we attended a church service one evening at Pastor LaFleur's church, which is where the feeding program happens. And so a little girl that I had noticed during the week came up to me, plopped down in my lap, and promptly fell asleep. And it was a moment that is just imprinted in my mind. And 3.5 years later, I can still remember her sitting there. You can see her up there. Just knowing that she felt safe and secure in my arms. God just put such a love for this girl that I barely knew. She's sitting in my lap, and I just prayed over her. And I said, God, just protect her. Help her to know you, to have hope for her life, that she won't live in poverty, but that she would grow up to know you and to make a difference in the lives of those around her. And it was such a powerful moment, and I knew God was speaking to my heart in that moment. And I mean, eventually she jumped up, hopped up, got down, scampered off, and I saw her a few more times during the week, but that moment made such an impact in my heart. And I knew that I couldn't leave Haiti and not do something about it. Something had changed inside of me that I needed to do something about. So I had talked to our trip director thinking, well, what on earth am I gonna do? And she comes to me and she said, you know what? That little girl is in the next batch of children up for sponsorship. Would you be interested in sponsoring her? Well, that wasn't a coincidence. Obviously, that was a God thing. So, of course, I said yes. And it was definitely God calling me to do something in the life of this little girl. It says in John, 1 John 3:17 through 18, if someone has enough money to live well and sees a brother or sister in need but shows no compassion, how can God's love be in that person? Dear children, let's not merely say that we love each other. Let us show the truth by our actions. So when I was in Haiti and when I was in Uganda, you're surrounded by so much need that it's just overwhelming. How could I ever begin to make a difference in the face of such poverty? What could I do as only one person? So child sponsorship is one of my big passions in life because I know that I can partner with that one child and I can make a difference in her life. I may not be able to transform the entire world, but I can transform that one life. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. I didn't look at the pictures last time, this morning, but looking there, you'll see that there's two different classrooms. One's a primary, one's a secondary, and then the kids on the right can't go to school. One of the things that really impacted me there is that not everybody gets an education. You'll see kids walking to school in their uniforms, and then you'll see other kids that are barely dressed standing there watching them yearningly, wanting to go, and it unfortunately kind of creates a caste system of kids that can go to school and those that can't. And then I know Uganda has attempted to create a universal primary school, but the difficulty with that is, first of all, they're not close enough to some of the people. And in the big cities, the classrooms are like 200 kids in them. The teachers aren't trained well. The teachers are overwhelmed. So even their attempt to try and change things is really struggling. And I've got some statistics for you. Today, education remains an inaccessible right for millions of children around the world. More than 72 million children of primary education age are not in school. And 759 million adults are illiterate and do not have the awareness necessary to improve both their living conditions and those of their children. Many emerging countries do not appropriate financial resources necessary to create schools, providing schooling materials, nor recruit and train teachers. Funds pledged by the international community are generally not sufficient enough to allow countries to establish an educational system for all children. As a result of poverty and marginalization, more than 72 million children around the world remain unschooled. Sub-Saharan Africa is the most affected area, with over 32 million children of primary school age remaining uneducated. Central and East Asia, as well as the Pacific, are also severely affected by this problem, with more than 27 million uneducated children. As of 2012, 31 million primary school pupils worldwide dropped out of school. In developing countries, every additional year of education can increase a person's future income by an average of 10%. Women less educated have more children. Women with a primary education are 13% more likely to know how to protect themselves from AIDS, which is very important in Africa. 53% of the world's out-of-school children are girls. And two-thirds of the world's illiterate people are women. Education empowers women to make healthy decisions about their lives. Youth literacy rates in America, South America and Europe are among the highest, 90 to 100%. Africa, less than 50% among children under 18. All of these issues have been talked about today, that we talked about today, are intertwined, obviously. If you're sick, you can't go to school. If your parents are sick, they're not going to get you to school. If you don't have clean water, you're going to be sick. So one does not exist without the other, so it's really impacted us a lot while we were there, and continues to. And I'm just going to read this thought by Carol Bellamy. Creating a world that is truly fit for children does not imply simply the absence of war. It means having the confidence that our children would not die of measles or malaria. It means having access to clean water and proper sanitation. It means having primary schools nearby that educate children free of charge. It means changing the world with children, ensuring their right to participate, and that their views are heard and considered. It means building a world fit for children where every child can grow to adulthood in health, peace, and dignity. That's by Carol Bellamy. Makama Yeba Zibwe.
Today, we're often inspired by the words of children that have come down through the generations. Anne Frank was a child who did not survive the Holocaust, but her words live on, and they can still inspire us. Anne said things like, "No one has ever become poor by giving," and how wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. So don't wait a single moment. This is our opportunity to offer our lives and our gifts to make a difference in the world.